Political jurisprudence explains the way in which government authority is constituted through the forms of law. It flourished in European thought between the 16th and the 19th centuries, and since the 20th century, it seems to have been in decline. The reasons are not obvious, but one explanation for this is the extending rationalization of thought and life. This is significant because it results in governmental activities increasingly being justified in scientific and in technical terms. That is, modern political authority is explained less today in terms of systems of belief, that is, the ideas that I've been talking about, the ideas that somehow equal citizens engage in some sort of deliberative process to consent to create a structure of government by through which they all will collectively engage and under which constitution they will live. And government today is much more to be explained by the material benefits that modern governments confer. These collective goods, defense, physical infrastructure, health, education, and welfare provision, these material provisions that enhance the well-being and the happiness of government subjects are often the justification itself for the existence of contemporary government. This growing technicization, I think that's a French word, this growing technicization of life has had a powerful impact on knowledge production. Its impact is illustrated by the growth of academic disciplinary specialization. Since the 19th century, we have seen the formation of relatively new scholarly disciplines, such disciplines as political science, economics, sociology, psychology. And under the hegemonic influence of schools of legal positivism, we've also seen the scholarly study of law being re-established on a much firmer scientific foundation. This development, one that I would argue sacrifices breadth of understanding for depth of knowledge, has made it difficult to sustain the discipline of political jurisprudence, exacerbated especially by virtue of the fact that the most prestigious branches of scholarly studies of law became those areas of private law that were much more susceptible to exegetical methods, to the doctrinal techniques on which the legal positivist philosophy was founded. This has been a continuing development over the last 150 years. Have we now then reached the point, have we reached the critical moment when the subject of political jurisprudence no longer has any significant contemporary resonance? It may have an aesthetic value, by which I mean it appeals to our aesthetic instincts to talk in terms of we, equal citizens, conferring authority through consent on the governments under which we live. So it may still have this aesthetic value, but does it really provide the conceptual framework any longer to explain the terms and conditions of contemporary governing arrangements? It's against that general trajectory and that background that I want in this final lecture to sketch very broadly the development since the 19th century, highlighting the importance of the work of French scholars. This entails an even broader overview, as Denis has implied, than the last two lectures. In order to highlight the orientation of French scholars, I will start by comparing them with German jurists. From the late 18th century, German public lawyers provided a distinctive account of political jurisprudence known as Staatslehre. Staatslehre presents itself as a single discipline embracing aspects of political theory, aspects of a sociological orientation, and aspects of legal analysis with the aim of presenting a scientific understanding of the institution of the state. It conceived the state as the master institution, which possessed an important monopoly, and that monopoly was that the state became the sole subject and container of what I've been calling the political. During the later decades of the 19th century, this German science of the state was undermined from within, with the result that the discipline itself became fragmented. The development was due to the growing influence of positivist ideas in public law, leading, in certain schools at least, to a reformulation of the discipline of Staatslehre as something analogous to Staatsrechtswissenschaft, the science of state law. The main characteristic of Staatsrechtswissenschaft was that it tried to expel questions of history and of politics from juristic consideration of the institution of the state. And it did so by presenting the state more narrowly, simply as a special type of legal person, an institution equipped with an artificial corporate personality. We see the last gasp of the attempt to hold on to the earlier, broader conception of state theory in German thought in Georg Jelinek's massive work of 1900, Allgemeine Staatslehre. But shortly after that work, the subject is broken up with, to simplify, on the one hand, Max Weber coming along and presenting a positivist and realist political science, and on the other, Hans Kelsen producing a normativist account of the theory of positive law. And the gap between the empiricist orientation of Weberian political understanding and the normativist orientation of Kelsen's jurisprudence tore that attempt to build a uniform idea of state theory asunder. Right, I've sketched very broadly those German developments so that we can see some aspects of a similar trajectory in French thought over that same period. But we might note that French scholarship took off in a different direction. The great mission on which French scholars were embarked, from Saint-Simon, Comte, de Tocqueville, and on to Durkheim, was much more explicitly social rather than political in orientation. Its general objective was to produce a science of society. While Germans saw the state as the master institution, French scholars conceived the state essentially as a derivative institution, one which achieved its orientation and purpose from the movement of society itself. Symptomatic of this development is the fact that many French liberals of the early 19th century the doctrinaire, such as Guizot, avoided using the word état altogether in favor of la gouvernement or le pouvoir. They similarly sought to draw a clear distinction between sovereignty and government, between pouvoir constituant and pouvoir constitué, between popular sovereignty and representative government. They even sought to confound modern understanding of the concept of sovereignty was by beginning to invoke such terms as the sovereignty of reason or the sovereignty of science, which is to render the term sovereignty pure figurative, purely metaphorical, of no real value, not doing any significant work. Once legal positivism gained support in the academy, and deductive, text-focused legal methods had established their dominance, a gulf grew between the methods of French jurists and the methods used by those who were seeking to address historical, political, or social questions. This suggests a disintegration in political jurisprudence. During the latter half of the 19th century, however, there was a resurgence of interest among French public lawyers in pursuing a broader methodology. In the vanguard were scholars such as Aurillac, Duguay, Esmin, Salé, and Berthelemy. Was this a restoration of political jurisprudence? I will argue that innovative though the work of these jurists undoubtedly was, their sociological and realist methods led to an undermining rather than a restoration of political jurisprudence. And in order to explain this, I should first say a few words about the post-revolutionary initiatives in developing a scientific knowledge of modern society. Let me begin by highlighting the point that the promotion of a functional conception of society was already in place at the origins of the French Revolution. In the first pages of Sieyès's What is the Third Estate, he argued that the nation consists not of three hierarchical feudal estates, but rather is to be understood as four distinct classes. His classification, which were into landed labor, industrialists, merchants, and then the professional and scientific classes, provides a purely functional division of society. This functional orientation, presaged by Sieyès, is then taken up by Claude Henri de Saint-Simon and Auguste Comte, and they develop a functional orientation of society along similar lines. Saint-Simon argues that by 1789, the feudal order had already lost its authority, and the revolutionary challenge was that of organizing the industrial and scientific system to replace the feudal order. Problems arose in the revolution, he argued, largely because the leadership of the revolution should have been assumed by scientists and industrialists. And instead it was taken up by lawyers. And these lawyers had their heads full of doctrines of the metaphysicians. This led, Saint-Simon argues, almost inevitably to the terrible atrocities and to the establishment of what he calls an absolutely impractical form of government. The underlying problem, he suggested, was that rather than changing the nature of power in modern society, it simply placed power in a different set of hands. modern governments, Saint-Simon maintained, will no longer command men. Their function will be limited to ensuring that all useful work is not hindered. Government command will be replaced by government coordination. Purely functional role for government. It fell to Comte Saint-Simon's faithful pupil to put these ideas into systemic form. In his Système de Politique Positive, Comte argued that human knowledge passes sequentially through three main developmental stages. The theological stage, which he calls the fictional stage, the metaphysical stage, which he calls the abstract stage, and the scientific stage, which he calls the positive stage. Only in the scientific era, Comte argues, are we able, through observation and reason, to discover the laws that govern phenomena. And only by doing that will we be able to bring to an end the disorder and uncertainties generated and occasioned by the 1789 revolution. The abstractions of metaphysics, Comte was suggesting, must be replaced by a science of social physics. Only then could the government of men be replaced by the administration of things. In this new type of order, the word right, droit, being a theological, metaphysical concept, is excluded from the proper language of politics. It is to be replaced by the language of duty, of obligation. These developments were taken a stage further by Emil Durkheim, one of the modern founders of sociology and the first holder of a chair of social science in France. Durkheim also promoted a functional method, most clearly seen in his pioneering studies of religion. These studies, we might note, were not undertaken to try to ascertain the truth or falsity of religious belief. Their objective was to examine the important function that religion played in society. The social function of religion, Durkheim explained, was to establish and reinforce the bonds that held society together. So with that functionalist orientation of modern social science being pioneered in France, I turn to the methods of the innovative French public lawyers of the late 19th century, especially Aurieux and Duguay. I have to admit right at the outset, for me, Maurice Aurieux is a puzzle. He is so French that does it get to a level where I cannot understand what he said. So what I present, the first bit I present, is straightforward to me. But then there are bits that don't make any sense. So here goes. Writing at the end of the 19th century, Aurieux maintained that the foundations of authority in France had still not settled after the violent upheavals of 1789. His thesis was that the revolution had been driven by three main factors. First, it hadn't been driven by the liberty, notwithstanding the claims. It had been driven by egalitarianism. Secondly, that this egalitarianism promoted in the name of a mystical demos of the people as a corporate whole, had led to a conflation of the general will with the legislative will, and this created an overbearing centralization of power. So it's egalitarianism first, centralization second. And thirdly, that the revolutionary spirit had imbibed a rationalist mentality that distrusted all traditional and customary ways of operating, of being. These, he suggested, had fermented the problems that still plague France. His reform agenda was derived from these three main factors. Most prominently, he argued that the revolutionary pursuit of equality through centralization had destroyed the authority of all intermediate institutions, those that operated between citizens and central government. And they, those intermediate associations, he argued, maintain the order and the equilibrium of the state. So in those respects, I think Auriou was working within the frame of political jurisprudence, and it all makes perfect sense to me. And I agree with it, actually. Auriou maintained that society is not founded in violence, but in power, and this power is able to build its authority only through a gradual social acceptance by subjects over time. In this respect, he recognizes the importance of power as potestas, as the building of rightful authority. He was also evidently a close follower of Montesquieu. Auriou's institutionalist theory that institutions make law, not laws make institutions, sits firmly within the frame of Montesquieu's idea of the spirit of the laws, and is consonant with the argument that social order founds itself on a balance of social of governmental powers. The bit I find puzzling about Auriou is the jurisprudential foundations of his thought. He claims to be a sociological positivist and a follower of Kant. But, as Olivier Beau has shown, his thought is also steeped deeply in natural law theory of a Thomist variety. Now, I don't understand how those two can be reconciled, but it's a puzzle. So this ambivalence, I think, is manifest in his central key concept of the directing idea, the idée directrice. This is the driving force of institutions. In some of his writings, it's given a functional orientation. But it doesn't seem to be functional in its spirit. Anyhow, if Auriou is puzzling, any ambivalence is resolved in the work of his main adversary, Léon Duguay. The reason is that it's evident that Duguay is engaged in an attempt to do nothing less than overthrow the founding assumptions of political jurisprudence altogether. Following Kant and Durkheim, he rejected all earlier theories of droit politique on the grounds that they rested on theological or metaphysical concepts. He sought in its place to build a science of public, he calls it a science of public law, on purely empirical foundations. Duguay's realist theory rejects the ideas of state and sovereignty, The state is a purely metaphysical concept, and since the state cannot be said to possess a will, the problem is not resolved by postulating a legal personality of the state. The only will that exists are individual wills, and therefore, for public law purposes, the individual wills of those who hold governmental power. He also rejects the idea of political power as being generated through any notion of rightful authority, signified through this concept of potestas. Political power, Dugi argues, is to be understood simply as a fact. Power is vested in those who govern, and since this power can never, in its origins, be legitimate, it cannot yield a right to govern. Those who hold power can govern legitimacy not by virtue of the origins of their authority, but only by virtue of them acting in conformity of what he calls, well, it's translated in English as the dual principle, la règle de droit. So what then is la règle de droit? It is, in short, the principle of social solidarity. Dugi presents this as a reformulation of the categorical imperative. Do nothing which can possibly infringe upon social interdependence, and do all that is within your power to ensure and increase social interdependence. This, he argues, is an objective law. It confers no rights. There exists no right to command, and individuals possess no rights of liberty or property. But it does establish a regime of duties. Everyone is subject to the objective law of being required to act to promote social solidarity. In Dugi's frame, then, governmental power derives from its function, which is to promote social solidarity. In this way, the idea of public service replaces the concept of sovereignty as the foundation of public law. Political jurisprudence, a discipline one would have to concede that's founded on a system of subjective rights, is overthrown and replaced with a regime of objective law. It is, Dugi suggests, merely an invention of crazy German public law theorists who sought only to legitimize force. We see this most vehemently when the nationalism in him comes out in his writings in 1914 and 1915. The true basis of modern public law, Dugi contends, is not command, but organization. We've heard Comte say that. We've heard Saint-Simon say it. We also heard Constant say that it's no longer command, it's about coordination. It's about organization, it's about administration. Oriou and Dugi are in their own ways innovators and radicals, and brilliant. Even if brilliantly wrong, they're brilliant. But it seems to me that the dominant tradition of French public law thought in the 20th century has been not one that follows either of those. Rather, it's one that has been a fairly orthodox acceptance of a legal positivist philosophy, which seeks to preserve legal science by severing questions of history and politics from heuristic understanding and investigation. This approach is seen most clearly in the pivotal work of Raymond Carré de Malberg, if only because of the scope and ambition of his study and his implicit engagement with the German tradition of Staatslehre. His Contribution à la théorie générale de l'État is the landmark study in this reorientation. In this work of 1920, Carré de Malberg placed the state at the centre of inquiry, but then removed any consideration of the sources of power on which the authority of the state is established and maintained. For him, the question of the basis of the state's legitimacy is converted from a juridical question into one of fact. Can the state, in fact, maintain order and work to protect the nation? In place of a political logic of power building, so that law becomes itself droit politique, is an aspect of the development of the power building. Carré de Malberg postulates a functional logic. Is the state able to deliver its objectives? In effect, as is evidenced in his transformation of the whole idea of sovereignty into one of sovereignty of the nation, he subordinates pouvoir constituant to pouvoir constitué. The institutions of government exist, they serve their purposes, and they should be bolstered against any sense of droit that might seek to provide sources that undermine their authority. Now, I'm speaking from relative ignorance, but it seems that the tradition of French public law since 1920 has been very... I, of course, exclude all of my esteemed colleagues in the Institut Michel Willy from this, but otherwise it's French legal positivism that dominates public law. If this is the 20th century legacy, does it signal the end of political jurisprudence? Before answering that question in the affirmative, I want finally to consider two broad lines of argument developed in the radical schools of French political philosophy with respect to this question. This, of course, is a huge topic. If I were not straining your patience too much, what I've just talked about would be one lecture, and this would be an entirely separate lecture. Even then, it would be very condensed. I take my cue on this question from the two observations of de Tocqueville that I mentioned at the end of the last lecture. The first is the claim that in modern society, modern democracies, there's scarcely any political question that does not eventually transform itself into a legal question. And the second is that in modernity, we see the rise of administrative government. We see the emergence of this immense administrative power of guardianship, which, far from being arbitrary, Tocqueville argues, is regular, provident, mild, but also absolute and minute in the range of its potential interests. And it arises because of the perception that modern governments need to promote the happiness, the well-being, the welfare of their subjects. This tension between growing legalization, and I can put that under the frame of sovereignty, and growing governmentalization, growing administrative power, this tension frames the analysis of some of the radical French political philosophers, who, if I strip them down to the basics, are not really as original as they present their theses. Take, for example, the work of Michel Foucault. Examining the implications of de Tocqueville's claim, Foucault argues that with the emergence of the social question, which he calls the problem of population, the activity of governing has moved beyond the juridical frame of sovereignty. He calls this process the governmentalization of the state, and consequently identifies a tension that emerges between sovereignty, understood as a juridical concept, and a new science of governmental reason, in which governing becomes a method, a functional method of employing tactics rather than laws, and of even using laws themselves as tactics. And therefore, it leads to a thorough instrumentalization of the phenomenon of law. The modern representation of power through the concepts of state, sovereignty, and constitution, the methods of political jurisprudence that I've been identifying, now, Foucault contends, have been displaced. Foucault is in effect suggesting that political jurisprudence belongs to this earlier metaphysical era, and that with the emergence of what he calls biopower, it has been more or less entirely overcome. I say more or less because he dissipates into some nonsensical triangle with sovereignty, governmentality, and discipline at the three elements of the triangle, and it just goes, I can't see the precise. He wants to say effectively sovereignty is being overthrown, but he doesn't actually say that explicitly. But to my mind, all that Foucault is doing is, well, he's doing a lot more of an original character, but with respect to this question, he is stuck within this tension between this two-sided character of the state that I mentioned in one of the earlier lectures, between nomos and thesis, between the normative state and the prerogative state, between societas, image of the state as rules, and universitas, the image of the state as a corporate enterprise. And obviously saying that that government today operates in that right side modality, and that gives us a quite different conception of power to those to that aspect of potestas by which we build rightful authority. Undoubtedly, he's working on that tension and making many original insights with respect to the contemporary significance of that tension, but he hasn't entirely overcome that tension. Anyway, moving on from Foucault, Foucault's thesis is, I think, in substance, if not in method, reinforced by two of Louis Althusser's quarrelsome offspring, Jacques Rancière and Alain Badiou. In Althusserian terms, their claim might be that the entire discourse of droit politique is part of what Althusser would call the ideological state apparatus. But each provides a gloss on that general theme. Rancière seeks radically to undermine the orthodox account of politics, which generally is defined as the set of procedures whereby the aggregation and consent of collectivities is achieved. He argues that this set of practices that in orthodox terms is called politics, whether it's in the frame of Aurieux, Dugui, or Carré de Malberg, forms nothing other than a disciplinary apparatus. It should, says Rancière, not be given the term politics, la politique. Rather, it should be given the name the police, la police. And since he includes in the arrangement the system, I'm quoting, the system for legitimating the distribution of power, so too should accounts of droit politique. For Rancière, politics, la politique, is an activity that is entirely antagonistic to the activity of policing. It is a term, he says, that should be reserved for action that challenges the established governmental regime in the name of justice and freedom. Politics exists, he argues, only after some major wrong has been identified, and it's through the specification of a gap between inequality and equality, or between empty freedom and true freedom, that politics emerges. So he conceives of politics as something that is entirely divorced from the business of running government, which is entirely disciplinary in character, is entirely a police arrangement, a policing arrangement. But when he asserts politics as justice, he is speaking the authentic language of natural right, albeit in a Jacobin voice refracted through the events of 68. Although there's no love lost between Rancière and Badiou, the latter has a similar but even more ephemeral conception of politics. Politics, says Badiou, cannot be governed by the state. Politics is not concerned with governing, and it cannot be anything to do with opinion or the formation of a common opinion, as is expressed through democracy. Politics is not concerned with the common will, he argues. It is specific, momentous, and concerned only with the truth. Badiou's position stands directly opposed to political jurisprudence, not least because political jurisprudence founds itself on the claim that the political, far from operating in accordance with the language of truth and falsity, works according to the logic of war and peace. Like Rancière, when he claims that the political is the domain of freedom and justice, we hear the authentic voice of Saint-Just. Before moving on to consider the work of scholars that could be said to be seeking to renew political jurisprudence, I should briefly mention the third of Althusser's intellectual children, Étienne Balibar, who seems to have deviated further from the structural Marxism than the other two. And I would want to take him as a bridge between natural jurisprudence and the attempt to restore political jurisprudence. I think Balibar is a bridge because his essay suggests how, in his own words, and I'm quoting now, a critical reading of Marx and Marxism could be combined with other interpretations of the traditions of political philosophy, Spinoza, Rousseau, Kant, Fichte, and above all with contributions to contemporary debates about universalism, racism, nationalism, and citizenship, and more generally what I, that is Balibar, calls a politics of the rights of man. In fact, there seems to me, when I read Balibar's essays, that there is little left of Marxism in his writing, in his political writings at least. His work seemed to me to assume an autonomous conception of the political, underpinned by a concept of sovereignty. He himself argues that just as Marx urged radicals to turn away from the apparent scene of politics and to focus on the real scene of economic processes, so Balibar inverts the pattern in order to demonstrate that material processes, economic processes, are themselves determined by the processes of the imaginary. This he calls the infrastructure of infrastructure. This claim, together with his other major concept, egal liberté, equal liberty, which is straightforwardly Rousseau's general will, suggests that Balibar acknowledges the continuing significance of political jurisprudence. Let me then turn, by way of conclusion, to three recent French scholars. Three recent French scholars whose work seems more directly to be an attempt to renew the subject of political jurisprudence. These are Claude Lefort and two of his disciples, Marcel Gaucher and Pierre Rosanvallon. All worked at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, and all have had significant links with the historian François Fouret. Notwithstanding differences in the methods between these three, the common theme of their various works, to me it seems, is to try to explain the significance of contemporary power in the in the contemporary world. Lefort's theorizing begins with a distinction between social reality and those general principles, such as popular sovereignty, equality, and rights, that aim to impose an order and meaning on that world, on that social reality. He suggests that there will always be a gulf between the real, that is, society, and its guiding principles, that is, the symbolic order. And in order to understand society, he suggests that we must grasp its form. And by form, he means we must grasp its symbolic order. And this symbolic order, Lefort calls the political. Le politique, the ground of politics, rather than la politique, the set of practices within an ordered regime. Lefort here situates himself firmly in the traditions of political jurisprudence. This orientation is reinforced with respect to his understanding of the nature of political power. He argues that political power, rightly, he argues that political power is not a thing to be possessed. It is a relation. It is a relation expressed through its representations. Further, within modern democracies, these power relations remain pluralistic and antagonistic, and this generates an indeterminacy set at the heart of political identity. Stability is achieved then only through the establishment of institutions that are able to give these generating principles a more precise meaning. But Lafour emphasizes that any such stability must always be relative, because within a democracy, the place of power, the locus of sovereign authority, remains empty. That is, it's purely symbolic. Lafour is a typically French style of dense philosophical analysis. It's impenetrable in places, and it's meaningless in some of his sentences. Nevertheless, and it's in that explicitly self-styled radical form. But what is he saying? He's saying something that is actually not so far removed from what Constant was saying, to my mind. Stripped to its basic elements, it amounts to a reworking of Constant's argument in a contemporary philosophical idiom. It seeks to carry on the practice of political jurisprudence. And this general objective is also being advanced today, I think, by Gaucher and Rosanne Vallant. I can't do justice to their extensive projects here. What they have in common is that they mount a challenge to the assumptions of the legacy of a Jacobin political culture that seeks consensus through abstraction and universality, and which conceives disagreement as a threat to the unity of the people. Further, while recognizing the threats presented by bureaucratization, they don't underestimate the forces of what Foucault is calling the governmentalization of the state. They don't assume that the administrative state is necessarily a state of servitude. Instead, they engage in a reworking of the meaning of democracy today. We see that most clearly in Rosanne Vallant's work, seeking to rework what democracy means, and the emergence of what he, and not very happily to my mind, calls counter-democratic institutions. Again, this is an exercise in building the authority of institutions that are the carriers of political authority. I don't suggest that this last group have answers. What I am suggesting is that the manner in which Lafour, Gaucher, Rosanne Vallant, and others have done is to sort to reformulate the political challenges facing the state today in a way that suggests that, notwithstanding the trajectory since the 19th century, the subject of political jurisprudence remains a live issue in French discourse presently. All I would add is that the challenge, from my point of view, because I'm a lawyer, a public lawyer, is the challenge of what one of our English, great English writers, E.M. Forster, called only connect. Only connect the passion to the prose. only connect the work of those who are seeking to revive what I've been calling political jurisprudence, now the philosophers and social theorists, with the heuristic critical examination of when Lefort talks about the gap between the real, the society, and its generating principles. These generating principles are heuristic, and therefore there is plenty of room for those public lawyers who want to maintain a more distant, objective, shall I call it, critical distance from the professional orientation of the subject, to engage in a reformulation of ways of thinking about public law of an innovative character, such as we see, however wrong I might think they are, we see with scholars like Bourdieu and Dugis. But on that note, I have tried your patience enough. I have come and revealed my utter ignorance of the French regime by giving you my outsider's perspective on it, and I thank you for your attention.